thank everybody for coming here this afternoon. I'm Bruce Dixon. I'm director of the Seeger Center for Asian Studies. And it's a great pleasure to introduce today Steve Balla. Steve is associate professor of political science, public policy, public administration, and international affairs. Did I leave anything out? He's got the longest title of anyone in the university, I think.
Lots of committee meetings.
Yeah. He began his career, and largely still does, work on the American public policy process, especially the public comment period before policies and regulations get adopted. China in recent years has begun experimenting also with public comment in their policy process. As they're going through the deliberation about what the final policy will be, seek public comment on some of the technical as well as the more basic issues involved with different policy areas. And that's what he'll be speaking about today. The broader topic is the internet political participation and governance reform in China. Is based upon his ongoing research in China. So, Steve?
Great. Thank you, Bruce. So, for centuries, China has been viewed from a Western perspective as this land of many contradictions. And I think today's China, space-age skyscrapers, river, peasant peddlers, is no exception to that. I was reading a book just yesterday where China was described as the mega enigma of the modern world. And so I want to begin by laying out three contemporary contradictions about Chinese politics, and then talk about how I bring these three contradictions together in the context of a single research project, an ongoing project that, broadly speaking, seeks to address larger issues in Chinese politics. So things like stability and change in the political system more generally. And I would argue that this is, of course, one of the more pressing concerns of our time in global politics. And so I'm going to try to connect the specific research that I'm reporting on right now with larger issues. Now, the research project itself, it's laid out in a series of published articles as well as an ongoing book project that I'm in the early stages of. It constitutes an examination of two things: government consultation and citizen feedback, both of which occur on the Chinese internet during the making of public policy, during the making of laws, the making of regulations. And specifically, most of the research that I've done to this point in the project that I'll be focusing on in the main here, most of the research thus far has focused on a specific case. It's a particularly salient case of government consultation and citizen feedback. It's one of healthcare reform. So I'll spend most of my time focusing on this particular case. But my aim is going to be to draw out some general lessons that we might be able to apply to consultation and feedback that we can then examine across ministries, across levels of government, in a variety of different institutional contexts. And I'm in the very early stages of doing just that, of taking the lessons from the healthcare case and thinking about how to design a research strategy for conducting a more general study of government consultation and citizen feedback. And I'll talk more toward the end of my remarks about what I'm doing at the moment in this broader project. Now, to be clear from the outset, my aim is not going to be, in some broad sense, to offer like a single overarching prediction about the future of the Chinese Communist Party or anything like that. In fact, my aim is kind of the opposite, in that as a social scientist, what I'm interested in is demonstrating how building up from the ground a body of empirical knowledge about, in my case, the internet, political participation, governance reform, how building up an empirical body of knowledge is going to be crucial and can help, sure, inform larger debates about the future of the CCP. And I do want to talk about larger implications. But that the notion is that by grounding these larger implications in a body of empirical knowledge that's, you know, contextually specific, that that the larger inferences that can be drawn from the research are going to be help move us past all or nothing claims about revolution, repression, that I would argue, at least in our public discourse, often characterize how we talk about, how we think about Chinese politics here in the West. So, three contemporary contradictions in Chinese politics. So the first, the internet in China today. Is it a means of democratization? Many argue this. My favorite quote along these lines, we'll go back in the archives for this one, comes from Ronald Reagan. The Goliath of totalitarianism will be brought down by the David of the microchip. Well, there's another possibility, of course, and that is that the Chinese government utilizes the internet to increase its surveillance, to suppress dissident activities, and ultimately to consolidate its authority going forward. So the democratic and authoritarian possibilities of the Chinese internet is the first contradiction. Second contradiction, and it's not unrelated, concerns political participation. So Chinese citizens today undoubtedly have more opportunities than ever, online, offline, to communicate with government officials, to express preferences about the issues of the day. But that said, each one of these mechanisms, whether we're talking about voting in village elections, posting on Weibo, whatever, each one of these mechanisms is subjected in one way or another to government-imposed limitations. So we have kind of this giveth, taketh away nature, if you will, of political participation today in China. And then finally, there are plenty of contradictions surrounding governance reform in China today. So what do we mean by governance reform? Well, the party in recent years has initiated a host of different initiatives that are designed to, in some way, recalibrate state-civil society relations. And so in some cases, it might be using public discussions to help establish budgetary priorities. It might be the movement towards sustainable energy policies. What all of these different kinds of approaches or governance reforms have in common is that they're all about changing the processes by which policy is made, or the structure, the institutional structures within which decision making occurs. And the idea in the end, of course, is to improve outcomes on the ground, to enhance the government's performance and citizen satisfaction with that performance. Now, one thing that all of these types of governance reforms, I think, inherently raise, and I think that's especially true for process-oriented governance reforms, and that's what I'll be talking about today, specifically this government consultation and citizen feedback. One concern is that these kinds of governance reforms, they merely provide window dressing, right? That they provide this appearance of popular legitimacy when, in fact, decision-making has occurred in advance at high levels leadership, much in the same way that leaders in China have made decisions in previous generations. So that this doesn't really amount to much of a substantive change. An alternative possibility, of course, is that these kinds of governance reforms signal some kind of new bargain or emerging bargain between state and civil society, right? That they're authentic in some ways, and that they represent mechanisms through which citizens can express preferences that at some level might at least be heard, if not then responded to. Now, as I pose these three questions, and I would argue that this is oftentimes how in public discourse here in the West they're posed, it's a series of all or nothing kinds of possibilities, right? The internet's going to either change everything or nothing at all about Chinese politics. Political participation, there's either brand new forms emerging as we speak, or it's really just business as usual. Governance reforms, they either again represent this new bargain, or they're really all bark and no bite. So the orienting premise then of this particular research project is to take these three elements start with the premise that in between kind of these extreme possibilities, revolution, repression, that there exists a large space potentially for there to be productive discourse, for there to be productive ways of understanding the internet, political participation, and governance reform. So given that there's presumably a large middle ground between these polar extremes, what I want to do today is demonstrate how these three elements that I'm working on, the internet, political participation, and governance reform, how they come together to manifest what I think is the often underappreciated evolution of Chinese politics and the policy-making process. I want to suggest that if we focus all of our attention on high-stakes confrontations, Tibet, Xinjiang, Hong Kong, we should absolutely pay lots of attention to those high-stakes confrontations. They're important on their own merits. They deserve a lot of attention. But I want to suggest that we ought to also look beyond these kinds of high-stakes confrontations, because there are all sorts of other kinds of interactions between state and civil society today that I would argue have important implications for adjudicating going forward things like stability and change in the Chinese political system. And I think a key point of departure for these in between the extremes interactions that I'm pointing to, a key point of departure for them is that they tend to occur in environments that are characterized by arenas where the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party is taken as a given. And so with that, government officials approach interactions with civil society. Well, they don't approach it from the perspective that they have an immediate need to justify the state's authority, to preserve the state's legitimacy. And I think from the viewpoint of citizens, they can approach these kinds of interactions that I'm referring to, not from the perspective of immediate democratization, but from the point of view of expressing opinions about issues in their everyday lives that they care about. So the place where I want to explore these possibilities is the institutional context of online consultation. So what's online consultation? It's a governance reform, so it fits under this broad rubric, and it's a process by which government officials, ministries, provincial governments, they offer citizens opportunities to provide feedback on proposed policies, on draft laws, on draft regulations. Now, as you might imagine, since this is consultation that's occurring on the internet, it's a relatively new phenomenon in China. There are early, quote-unquote, historical examples of this, but it really got going about 6 years ago when the central government announced that it would make use of the internet of online consultation as a standard method of inviting public opinion on draft laws and regulations. So there are plans in the years ahead, and there are various stages of development, to eventually, perhaps, create a single clearinghouse that facilitates the conduct of online consultation across government organizations, across levels of government, a place to catalog practices in online consultation. But to this point, we're not anywhere near that. And so at this point, government experiences with online consultation are pretty limited, and therefore citizen experiences are pretty limited as well. So for that reason, I'm going to focus here through most of my remarks on one early, highly salient application of online consultation as a way for exploring citizen feedback in this process and trying to see what we might infer about more general issues in Chinese politics. This application, healthcare reform, like I've said, it's one of the most important domestic policy initiatives that's currently in play on the ground in China, and there are a number of reasons for this. In the post-reform period, China's performance on healthcare issues has, if anything, regressed. In the Mao period, it was a positive outlier. When you look at its stage of development, its health outcomes were above average. That's now flipped. Insurance rates, for example, have skyrocketed. And this is not true only in the poor countryside. It's also true in urban areas, obviously to a lesser extent. As a result of these kinds of poor performance outcomes, there are other implications. Household savings rates, right? It's well documented. They're in China among the highest, if not the highest, of any nation in the world. That has implications in turn for the government's ability to move past an export-driven model of economic development. So there are all kinds of economic implications. There are also political implications in that in recent years there have been thousands and thousands of protests, health-related protests, at hospitals, clinics, government offices. People have been injured. There have been millions and millions of dollars in property damages. And so the government is under some kind of pressure to improve its performance in the area of healthcare. Now, not only is the issue of healthcare reform important on its own merits, it's important from the perspective of governance reform because healthcare is one of the early applications of online consultation. And so given that it's one of the early important applications, this is a case that provides us with the opportunity to lay out some baseline expectations. So baseline expectations that can then be, we can compare with future experiences, baseline expectations that we can then compare with future analyses of online consultation. So what I've done in this regard, in the spirit of laying out some baseline expectations of doing an initial study of online consultation, is assemble a pair of two data sources with regard to the operation of online consultation in this healthcare case. And these two data sources, I think, allow me to make some headway in terms of analyzing online consultation in this case, but then also hopefully using this case as a marker for some larger insights that we might be able to draw from the case. So what are the two data sources? In October of 2008, so this was in the early days of this online consultation movement, the central government circulated via its own website, a proposal to reform the nation's healthcare system. Now, this proposal was broad brush stuff. It basically laid out the principles that the reform system would be expected to meet at some point in the future. So things like provide universal access to basic health services, both in rural and urban locations, to increase the compensation of physicians, to increase the safety, the availability, the affordability of pharmaceutical products. These kinds of broad goals. Concurrent with the announcement of the proposal, the central government invited interested parties to come to the website and log their own comments, so to react to the proposed reform initiative. And during the 1 month public feedback that followed, nearly 30,000 comments were logged at the website. That's one of the comments that we're looking at right now. Now, those comments then, they serve as the first source of data in the research that I'm reporting on here. And so we have the ability to take a look at and analyze just what was said. Yes, Steve?
Are those anonymous or not anonymous?
So there's a field where you can enter your name. And so this person has recorded their name. Is it their actual name? We don't know. And if you look in the name field across these 30,000 comments, there are lots of names. There are also lots of things that aren't names, clearly. And there are also a lot of blank fields. So you didn't have to put anything into that
register
field.
Register with your email.
Right, nothing like that in this particular case. Yep. So we know what the commenters said, and that's the first source of data that I'll be drawing off of here. The second source of data constitutes a survey of a sample of more than 500 of these participants. So there is a survey instrument that was sent out to a sample of these respondents. These are the first five items in the survey instrument. And I'll talk more about what exactly the survey instrument asked. One point to emphasize right at the start, this is not a probability sample of respondents or anything like that. So the way in which the sample was constructed is that when you submit your comment, there's a link that you can click on. There it is in the circle. There's a link that you could click on to leave an email address. And so of the nearly 30,000 participants, several thousand left email addresses. And so every one of those comments that had a valid email address attached to it was sent a survey instrument. They received via an email attachment a survey instrument that asked them a battery of questions about who they are demographically, why did they submit a comment, what are their expectations about the government's responsiveness, what's their general political activism. I'll talk a little bit more about some of those questions as we go on. So there were about two dozen questions that those respondents were asked. And so there were 541 responses to that survey instrument. And so it's those respondents who are going to be at the heart of the analysis here. So for those 541 respondents, we know who they are demographically, we know something about their motivations, their attitudes, their behaviors, and then we also know what they said in response to the government's healthcare proposal. So again, This is not necessarily a sample that's representative of healthcare commenters, of Chinese internet users, of the Chinese population. I'll say some things about some comparisons between this sample and other populations. The idea, though, here is to treat these participants as a target of opportunity. That this was really one of the first times on which the central government conducted this kind of online consultation, where both the comments and information about the participants was available. So just a target of opportunity to generate some information about citizen feedback in the process. Now, for those 541 respondents who we have survey data for, I also conducted a content analysis of their participation. So analyzed what they actually said. So coded along a number of dimensions their comments. So a couple of examples of some of the coding that I'm talking about here. So each of these 541 comments was evaluated in terms of the extent to which it expressed positive or negative sentiments toward the healthcare proposal, toward the current healthcare system, things like that. The substantive focus of the comment was recorded. So what did they actually talk about? What issues in healthcare? So did they talk about the relative balance of market and government in the healthcare system? That was actually a huge issue. Did they talk about rural healthcare? Did they talk about traditional Chinese medicine? That was one small controversy. What role should TCM play in the Chinese healthcare system going forward? So the content of the comments was coded along a number of substantive dimensions like that. And also the way in which the comments were argued, the nature of the evidence that was presented in the comments. So, for example, did they reference personal experiences? By contrast, were they citing scientific data, research analyses, things like that? So on a variety of dimensions, the nature of their arguments, the nature of their evidence was coded. Now, I think that separately and then ultimately together, these two sources of data allow us to get at a couple of questions about citizen feedback in the context of healthcare reform. First, well, who are these participants? What were their characteristics demographically? What were their attitudes? What are some of their general behavioral markers? Secondly, what did they say? What did they say politically? What did they say substantively? How engaged were their comments with the issues in the healthcare proposal? And then finally, what's the connection between who they are and what they said? And so, for example, is it the case or not that who they are demographically is associated with how positive or negative they were, how informed they were in their comments? Is there sort of underlying motivation? Is that associated with the approach that they took in their comments? I'm going to say more in a few minutes about why theoretically it would be important to understand that connection between who they are and what they said. But that'll be the third piece of this. Now, my larger aim, again, beyond studying these participants and this policymaking process, is to, again, establish this baseline, develop some expectations that might inform a larger study of online consultation and citizen feedback. So I'm really aiming to, at some level, demonstrate the feasibility, the methodology, treat it as a pilot kind of test, if you will. And as we speak, I'm in the beginning stages of taking the analysis that I'm about to report on and the results that come out of that analysis, taking that and building on it in this larger book project that seeks to look across policy areas, across ministries and levels of government. Now, I want to emphasize that the focal point here is on citizen feedback. It's not, for example, on government decision making. And why is that the case? Well, at some level, the policymaking process in general in China and in this healthcare case remains in large part pretty opaque. And so it's difficult to process trace, to take a moment like this consultation and then associate it with subsequent decisions that were made by policymakers. That's something that I intend to work on in the larger project. But for this part of the research project, the focal point is on the citizens, on who they are, what they said, and what we might infer from that. And I want to argue that studying citizen perspectives, studying the behavior of citizens in these consultation processes, I think this is a crucial element. If online consultation is going to perform well as an instrument of governance reform, then one crucial element in the process has to be, you know, serious, engaged participation on the part of citizens. And so that's the aim here, is to start by studying citizen feedback and see what we might infer about the prospects of online consultation from that vantage point, knowing that what's to come, what's left unsaid at this point by the research, is that other piece of the puzzle that we'd obviously love to know lots about. Did the comments matter? How did they impact on decision making? So that's to come in the larger project. So, who were these participants then? Well, for starters, more than 80% of them were males, and that's different from the population of Chinese internet users 6 years ago. The Chinese internet still was more male than female, but the gap was pretty small, and it was still closing at that point. Not so for this group. This is an overwhelmingly group of male participants. The median age is 36. From my vantage point, I'm on the wrong side of that median. That looks pretty young to me. But actually, from the vantage point of the Chinese internet, especially circa 2008, that's actually a pretty, that's a pretty mature population, because the Chinese internet at that time tracked very, very, very young. And so this is unusual in that regard. Collectively, there's variation here, and I'll speak to that later. Collectively, this set of participants was well-educated. So when we take these two categories together, those who have as their highest level of educational attainment a college degree, undergraduate study, and those who have done graduate work of some type or another, when we combine those categories, that's nearly 90% of the sample. So it's a well-educated group. It's a professional white-collar group. They're coming from, you know, professions like lawyers, journalists, things like that. The classification in Chinese on the survey is 专业 技术 人员. So that's the specific category into which a lot of the participants fell. They sectorally, many of them are from, perhaps not surprising, the medical and health industry. So when we step back and we look at this group of participants, right, they collectively occupy well-established places in Chinese society. They definitely constitute this elite, specialized group of participants. Now, given this set of participants, then what were their motivations? Why did they participate? By nearly a 2-to-1 margin, and this might be surprising depending on your prior notions here, by nearly a 2-to-1 margin, the participants expressed indicated in the survey that expressing concerns with the proposal was a more important motivation for them than supporting the government's plan as it had been developed to that point. So, depending on, again, what your priors might be, if you're thinking this is a government-sponsored consultation process occurring on a government website, we might expect to not hear a lot of, you know, critical remarks, to not hear a lot of pushback from the participants. And that's, in fact, the case. If we look at other research on these kinds of government-sponsored internet spaces, that that citizens tend to say things like, "I was hesitant to complain given the institutional environment that this conversation was taking place in, that this communication was occurring in." But in this case, expressing concerns far outstripped any kind of more positive rationale for participating. And this is also driven home by the fact that many of the participants expressed, when asked, "Why did you do it? What are your aims in participating?" Many of them, you know, said, "I want to influence the direction of this reform initiative." And again, depending on our priors, we might find that a bit surprising if this doesn't jibe with sort of traditional authoritarian decision making or consultation. So I think in general, it's what emerges from the survey responses is that these participants aren't simply cheering the government on. There's something more than that happening in these comments. And I think that when we look at the content of their comments, as well as their responses to the survey, we can see kind of this pushback on the part of the citizen participants. So the vast majority of comments were negative in their orientation in some way or another. Now, in some instances, it was what we might call constructive criticisms, but in others, there were more fundamental challenges to government decision makers. So, just a couple of short excerpts from a couple of longer comments. The plan is too technical to understand. I suggest making it more readable for someone like me, a college student who's not in medical school. Okay, not really critical, a kind of mild response. Here's another excerpt. This plan basically cheats us. If the government cannot provide us with a plan that satisfies the majority of people, we will be forced to use our power to make you bureaucrats pay. And not only was there a lot of this kind of pushback in the comments, the commenters often backed up their complaints with information, with substantive knowledge. And so it wasn't just sort of ranting against the government. So again, a couple of excerpts that demonstrate some of the kinds of argument strategies, that demonstrate some of the sources of data and information that the commenters were drawing off of. I work at a hospital in a rural area. The new rural cooperative medical system was implemented in 2008. But it does not work to the benefit of peasants. Originally, 1,300 RMB was enough to cover the cost of an appendectomy. Now, however, the operation costs 3,000 to 4,000, and patients must pay 1,300 to 1,500 out of pocket. So drawing on experiences. According to the World Health Report 2005, the percentage of national health care expenditures covered by governments was between 80 to 90%. In developed European countries, 45.6% in the United States, and 56.3% in Thailand. Many poorer countries have implemented universal healthcare systems. The Chinese government, however, covers only 17% of healthcare expenditures, the fourth lowest of any country in the world. Furthermore, 80% of this paltry 17% is used to cover the medical expenses of a relatively small number of elites, namely party members and government cadres. Now, to this point, I've been highlighting central tendencies in citizen feedback in terms of who they are on average, what they said on average. But of course, within these central tendencies, there's wide variation. Not everybody fits, fits sort of the modal kind of outcome. So these variations, I think, across the commenters, across their comments themselves, beg some important questions. For example, do differences in who the commenters are, what their demographic characteristics are, what their subjective motivations are, do these kinds of differences have an impact on what they said? Like, so do those differences, are they associated with things like the tone of the comment that was submitted, with the level of substantive knowledge embodied in the comment? And so to get at this kind of question, I think it's important to ask ourselves, well, what's important about it? Why would we care about why those two things might or might not be associated with one another? Well, in research historically on Chinese political participation in general, so in venues like village elections, petitioning, in general, in research on Chinese political participation over the last couple of decades, what's emerged is a way of approaching venues of participation whereby the characteristics of the participants themselves, again, their demographic characteristics, their subjective motivations, these characteristics can serve as markers of the underlying nature of the participatory mechanism. And so the notion is that if the typical participant tends to be somebody who's internally efficacious, someone who has confidence in their ability to understand what the government's doing and to influence what the government's doing, that if participants are democratically oriented, they support the expansion of local elections and other democratic institutions, that in modes of participation where these types of participants dominate in terms of just participation and in terms of their engagement with the decision makers, then that kind of pattern would serve as evidence that the form of participation at some level has authenticity. It's something more than a traditional authoritarian kind of top-down created mechanism that doesn't do much more than ratify authoritarian decisions. And so at some level has broader markers of authenticity, of communication. And so that's the general approach that research in Chinese political participation has taken over the last couple of decades. And that's the approach that I'm taking in this particular case as well. And so what I've done to get at that association between who they are and what they said, and then to try and infer up what that might say about the nature of online consultation, I did a variety of analyses of the associations or lack thereof between these two pieces. And I'll put to the side the details of measurement, estimation, and all of that, and get right to the punchline and talk about some of the key results. So the punchline is that it's indeed the case in this particular context, the healthcare reform consultation, it's indeed the case that those participants who were high in internal efficacy, who evidenced a democratic orientation, that it's exactly those participants who were the most substantively engaged in their comments as measured by what they were saying. And how do we know that? What are some of the specific results that feed into that overall story? Well, for example, those participants who indicated that they participated in healthcare reform in other ways, that they in general are active in talking with policymakers, those participants were the most engaged in their comments, more so than participants who said, no, this is the first time I've ever participated. Those participants who had instrumental rationales, like they wanted to do things like influence decision making, they thought that they could maybe move healthcare reform, or at least that was their aspiration, they too were the most substantively engaged in their comments. Same thing for participants who indicated that they had hope that online consultation, that this process could increase fairness in decision making, it could increase responsiveness in decision making. These again were exactly the participants who were the most engaged substantively, as evidenced by the kinds of things they were saying in their comments. And so again, the inferential leap here that we're asking the data to make, that I'm asking the data to make, is that, like, on the basis of who it was that was participating and how they were participating, so on the basis of the attributes of the participants, their perceptions of the process, how they behaved in the process, that can tell us something about the deeper underlying nature of the process itself. And so, again, we're using citizen notions, right? You know, that as they reveal it through their behavior, to, in this case, make inferences about what happened in this context and what it might say about online consultation as a governance reform. And so again, with the patterns that we've observed here, the notion would be that that's exactly the pattern that we would expect if this process was playing out a way as something more than authoritarian ratification, that it has something more than that going on. Now, given that this is the approach that I've taken here, what do I want to suggest, you know, might come out of this particular case study, and then how am I right now taking the lessons from the case study and applying them on a more broader scale? So three takeaway messages, and I'll talk about what I'm doing right now. So the online consultation, at least in the context of healthcare reform, I would argue, evidenced. It operated in a way that suggests that it's not politics as usual, but it's not a radically different type of public participation. That it really represents this evolution in government decision making and citizen participation in that process. Now, why do I say that? Well, historically, when we think about policymaking, modes of policymaking in China, historically, going back to the early days of the PRC at least, the dominant modes were things like the highest leaders in the party making decisions and then mobilizing the public behind those decisions. Or if there was disagreement between high-level decision makers, those would be resolved prior to going public. In contrast, this online consultation mechanism, at least in the healthcare case, played out in a way that I think is more consistent with what's been called the reach-out model of policymaking. That is, that policymakers solicit citizen feedback at a stage in the policymaking process prior to finalizing decisions, when there's still perhaps some disagreement among policymakers about which way to go. And that's certainly the case, I think, in the context of healthcare policy. There was really a wide-ranging debate that was apparently going on at high levels of decision-making. So this is certainly different than historical modes of decision-making, of involving citizens in the policymaking process. But I want to suggest it's not radically different, in that the boundaries of citizen feedback, they're kind of narrowly prescribed, right? So citizens have the opportunity to offer feedback on this particular proposal, on a particular type of policy that was put out for proposal. And so again, I think this represents something in between those extremes of politics as usual and some kind of radical new form of state-civil society relationship. Second, and it's not unrelated, the citizens, at least in this healthcare case, they behaved as if online consultation matters, as if their participation might make a difference, that it could have an impact on government decision making. How do we know that? Well, the citizens demonstrated, by and large, serious engagement with the political issues, with the substantive issues at stake here in the healthcare case. And so I think that kind of engagement demonstrates one element that online consultation is going to need to have going forward, citizen buy-in, if it's going to operate as an instrument of governance reform that can ultimately improve decision-making processes and decisions on the ground. Now, finally, given what we've observed in the context of healthcare reform, I would describe myself right now as being cautiously, tentatively optimistic about the prospects of online consultation as a governance reform. Drawn from this particular case, I think that online consultation has the markers of a space on the Chinese internet where citizens, where state and civil society can come together and address certain types of issues confronting Chinese society, the Chinese economy, the Chinese political system. And so I think that there's the possibility that there can be these productive exchanges, that political participation here, I'm cautiously optimistic about it at this point. What I'm doing right now is a means of moving beyond the case study and trying to apply some of these lessons, some of these thoughts to online consultation more generally, is I'm collecting information about the online consultations that have and that are occurring across ministries of the central government and at the provincial levels as well. Now, it's way, way too early to talk about any kind of results from this part of the project. We're in the midst of the data collection stage. And this literally involves going website by website. And so there's no central repository for information about online consultation. And so at this point, the data search involves going from ministry website to ministry website, from provincial website to provincial website, looking for evidence of online consultation. I'll be in my office doing more of this afternoon. So it really is going on right now. One thing I can say, though, based on the data that have been collected so far, is that ministries and provincial governments demonstrate wide variation in their online consultation practices. That is, in terms of do they do it or not? Some not at all. Some are using it quite regularly, apparently. When they use it, there are wide variations in terms of how much information they disclose about the online consultation. Do they disclose that they're doing it? Do they, as in the case of the healthcare reform case, do they disclose the policy, the comments, the whole process? And so that, of course, begs a question, one of the early questions that's coming out of this next stage of the project. Well, what are the conditions under which online consultation is implemented? When do government organizations turn to it? And when they turn to it, what kinds of factors matter? What kinds of factors govern how much information is disclosed? And so I'd expect to have some initial answers to these kinds of questions in the next couple of months. Now, I want to suggest coming back you know, to this notion at the outset, you know, that China's this land of many contradictions. I want to suggest that, like, my aim has been to orient our attention toward these kinds of, you know, dramatically different, you know, vistas, to orient ourselves, to take a social scientific orientation. And it's not the only one, but I think it's an important one that can contribute to our understanding of these broader dilemmas, these broader contradictions. And so my aim in stating, for example, that I'm cautiously, tentatively optimistic in this context, I'm not in general necessarily rosy about China's prospects across the board. So I think we need to be careful. And my orientation, I think, as a social scientist is to suggest that we ought to bracket what we say based on the policy area that we studied, based on the process that we studied, in my case, based on the data sources that I drew off of. And so hopefully I've been cautious enough in drawing inferences from the case to larger issues without being paralyzed. Because I think we still can draw larger inferences, but we always want to make sure that we're bracketing our inferences, I think, in these variety of ways. And so I think that's a contribution that social scientists can make that'll stand alongside the contributions of journalists, policymakers, and others, that as we in the West continue to try to understand and make sense of these different contradictions in modern Chinese politics. Thank you. Do we have time for questions?
Yeah, about 20, 25 minutes.
Great, fantastic. All right, go.
Yeah. I'm sorry I missed the first 5 minutes, but that was really excellent. I guess my question has to do with the category of citizen consultation. Because in this case, your data shows that these are citizens, but a very unique, self-selected, tiny group of citizens who, you know, well-educated, white-collar guys who, I guess the question is, to what extent do their views really represent much of anyone in China? And then consultation, this to me seems to carry the notion of not equity, but some sort of open sort of table where people can talk. And I guess my question would be, is this a consultation or is this more one more aspect of what I see as a governance strategy of incorporating people who are in the private sector who are in essence part of the governing elite? So it's sort of the white, like the 100 Flowers campaign on the internet, but they're not going to get shot afterwards.
Yeah, I don't think you're wrong, right? Because this is an elite group. They're, you know, they have specialized knowledge about the policy area at stake. And so that's why I'm trying to calibrate what I'm saying, what I'm inferring about this, because this isn't like democratization or some kind of like massive opening of the relationship between state and civil society or anything like that. So this is like just the next teeny tiny step forward. Now, you know, so I think what that means is that for that elite specialized group, I do think this represents a new opportunity for them to have input at a stage in the process where they might not have previously had input. So I don't think this, you know, means nothing, but I do think you're right. It doesn't mean much for a larger, you know, a larger set of Chinese citizens or internet users. Now, will we find the same thing across episodes of online consultation when we look at other types of policy areas or we start to go to more local levels? I don't know. And, you know, that's what the research is for.
And this group, for the data set, have you seen any difference in the comments in terms of critique between those who self-selected to participate in the survey versus the many who didn't?
Yeah. So this is a big issue, right? Yeah. Because of the way the sample was constructed. So we did do some comparisons of people who responded to the survey and those who didn't. And the short of it is, on a lot of dimensions, you don't see a difference that's worth, you know, worrying about. On a few dimensions, though, you know, it does look like, you know, there are a couple of dimensions on which the survey respondents are a bit different. So again, that's going to temper, right? You know, like what, you know, how we want to think about what we found here. But that was certainly a concern, right? Of like, how do we deal with that? How do we deal with the fact that there might be those differences? Also, you know, the survey respondents, we also compared. Well, we compared them on a number of dimensions to those who didn't respond. So The answer, I mean, I'd love to be able to say, I stand here in front of you and tell you they're perfectly represented. That's just not true. It's not off by a lot, but it's not perfect. So yeah, we gotta be worried about that, and it limits what we can say. Yeah, Steve.
Yeah, following up on that, I'm wondering, so you did the content analysis for those who completed the survey.
Yeah.
You just said that.
Well, we've done content analysis for those who didn't.
But
yes.
What about those who didn't put their email down? So you've actually got,
For all of those groups.
Self-selected to be non-anonymous
right.
by virtue of putting their email down. You've got a group of people
right.
who have chosen to be more anonymous.
Yep.
And so I wonder kind of how would the averages in terms of the content analysis differ between the group that put an email down and the group that did not?
Yeah, and so let me say a little bit more about that, right? Because you're absolutely right. It's not just did you respond to the survey or not if we asked you, but it's the people who didn't put the email addresses in the first place. Or there's even this other group that put information in the email field, but it wasn't actually an email address, or like, so was that just random, or was that some kind of
intentional signal?
Exactly. So we sort of did some content analysis across the various dimensions. And so when I say that it doesn't match up perfectly across the groups, well, I don't see any obvious pattern. Like one group was like more stridently negative than another group. But so when you compare them across a bunch of dimensions, it's like, well, this group is more negative this way, but this other group is more negative that way. And so what I don't see is sort of any kind of lining up. Like that would have been right, the ideal world, they all, no difference at all. But the differences aren't systematic, right? And so like you'd expect to find systematic differences if, they were either leaving an email or not because of some underlying disposition. But we don't see that in when we do the content analysis across the different subgroups. What do you make of that? I don't know.
One other question would be, so one group of people that I might expect to see on this would be the kind of cheerleaders, you said. People
right.
are just kind of coming in and saying, government's doing a great job, do more of this.
Right.
And they might be more inclined to put their email down because they want to be, even
right.
in a small
right.
way, recognize that I'm cheering on. So I wondered if you could kind of systematically identify some group of people that seem to be
right.
kind of the cheerleaders. That, they're kind of a different group of people from the ones who are being critical then.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I haven't been able to figure out what it is, right, that is separating the, because there certainly are those in the group who are more positively predisposed. But I was surprised, just in general, across the board, how much sort of pushback there was in the comments, right? Because I had this prior, thought based on, anecdote, based on prior research about these kinds of online interactions between government decision makers and citizens that occur in government spaces, that suggest, there's going to be a real hesitance to complain. And I was really, what we found did not mesh with my priors on this. And so I was surprised at how much negativity there was across the board in the comments. And if you think there was censorship in the comments, because that's a whole nother issue that's out there, if you think that, in that process of going to the website, logging a comment, and a comment becoming visible, if you're worried about censorship, I can't say, right, whether there were other comments that I'm not looking at. I can tell you, I got a database of about 30,000 of them. It's supposedly the universe. Do I know for sure? Not. But what I also can tell you is that, well, if there is censorship, if this is the amount of revealed criticism that the government allows, it was kind of astonishing to me. And so that's definitely what I was not expecting. Yeah. Yeah, Patrick.
Thanks. That question about your thoughts about the efficacy of this type of consultation
yeah.
and its impact on governance reform compared to other types of consultation, both maybe within government or sponsored by government, such as you mentioned the reach out model,
right, right.
where policymakers would reach out to academicians or others that ask for their votes, but also things that are outside of, say, official consultation. Whether it's internet, Weibo, informal popular opinion, and whether or not government is responsive to those as well. Just your thoughts. I know you mentioned that you didn't really look at efficacy as much.
Yeah, I mean, there was other consultation. I can speak to this particular case. There was other consultation that was happening before and after this particular piece of the story that I'm looking at. So for example, prior to that proposal being circulated, the government went and asked about a dozen organizations to produce white papers. So this is a type of consultation, but a very different type of consultation. So to produce white papers about, you know, suggested directions for healthcare reform. And so these were people at Beida, at Tsinghua, at Renmin, like people who are the healthcare experts at these universities. They also reached out to international NGOs, World Bank, World Health Organization, and so there was that element as well. One price of entry to be, you know, to be one of the players in that consultation, one price of entry is that you couldn't ever publicly release your white paper. And I've never been able to find evidence that they were leaked or anything like that. What I have heard through sort of the hush-hush back channels is that they were all over the place, with some arguing for very market-oriented solutions, others very government-driven healthcare systems, and that that might have been one reason why there was this consultation, because it's not unrelated in that, in that reach-out model. When there's that kind of uncertainty at high levels of decision making, that's when you do this kind of reach out. And so, yeah, even in this case, there were other kinds of consultations that, now can I say those white papers had a big impact? I don't know, right, because of how opaque the process was. And one of the people who wrote that, wrote a white paper. He had an office for me down the hall at Beida. I mean, I was down the hall from him for a year, and I could never get an answer to that. So, yeah, yeah.
So the World Bank and a lot of other agencies are coming out and saying that there's a need for a data revolution. And it was two questions related to the ability to access data. One would be, what type of data would you ideally need if you really wanted to understand the impact of online consultation in China? And secondly, what type of data do you think the Chinese government is going to be likely to start producing in the near future in response to either claims of its citizens or its international obligations under different agreements?
Mm-hmm.
If you could comment on that, please.
Yeah, what I'd like to see, like, what would my wish list look like, say, if we just take online consultation? I'd like a central clearinghouse, right, where anytime you do an online consultation, the proposed policy gets posted to, you know, a single website. All of the comments that get submitted also go through that single website. All of the supporting analyses that went into the government's creation of the proposal. So in the healthcare case, it would be, say, things like white papers and cost-benefit analyses or whatever. You know, I'd love to see all of that in one place. That's a long, long way off, right? So that's just the wish list. Where are we in reality? I think where we are in reality is like we are with many governance reforms. It's often a function of a particular leader in a particular organization being open to some new way of, you know, interacting with civil society. And that's the case if you look historically across some of these governance reforms, like what's been going on, you know, for years down in Wenzhou, some of the, you know, the discussions, public discussions of budgets and the deliberative polling and stuff that goes on there. It's often tied to like specific leaders, right, who had an interest, who had a contact with the West, who had an interest in this particular reform. And then when the leader moved on, you know, the whole kind of reform, you know, sort of faded away when the next regime came in. And so that's why I think to have some kind of institutionalized mechanism would be great. But I think at this point, I don't know for sure. As I'm looking at online consultations, and I'm seeing it vary tremendously from ministry to ministry or province to province, I don't know for sure. But one guess I would have, one hypothesis I'd have is that, you know, right, yeah, there might be something systematic going on here. But it also might be sort of ad hoc in the sense that it's a function of leadership. So I think that also plays into how I'd answer your second question, right? Because, you know, international obligations, you know, ascension to the WTO and things like that. I think oftentimes how that plays out, you know, in specific decision-making contexts in specific institutions, I think oftentimes a key part of that, you know, part of the puzzle is the leadership. And again, that's not something that's like systematic and institutionalized that tends to have longevity. So, So that would be something that, you know, would make me think this is going to be slower rather than quicker. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Are you aware of any studies being done within China at the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences or something like that, where they are doing studies such as yours?
I don't know of any offhand. I have research partners in China who I've worked on various pieces of this with. They're academics who are like me, working from outside of the process. And so one of the next steps in the project, as I look to the larger book project, I'm hoping to spend next year on the ground in China. And one of my aims would be to start working on this from the government consultation side of it, as opposed to just the citizen feedback part. And so I'd want to spend a year on the ground trying to network and make those kind of connections that would help me answer that question. Because right now my answer is I don't know. Yeah.
This is a question about the research as a whole rather than what you just presented. You were talking about how it would be great to have a central clearinghouse for all of this material on one website, but I was actually wondering the opposite, if there's been any surveys or reaching out to citizens on social media like Weibo or even Weixin.
Yeah, I mean, certainly government agencies do that. I don't know systematically, but I mean, that does occur. The other thing that happens on social media is that sometimes these consultations are discussed in social media. And that would be another interesting, I think, take on this. Another research project would be to study Weibo-type discussions about these policymaking processes. So in general, I think there's a lot more that can be done because I mean, obviously here my focal point has totally been on the architecture that the government created and study the interactions in that space. But in many instances, the conversation spills over. So there's a great example of this. One of the more high-profile online consultations, and so one of the ways I want to bracket what I'm doing here, is the healthcare case is highly salient on the one hand, but it doesn't represent an immediate threat to the legitimacy of the party. So I would think that that's exactly the kind of issue where you'd expect to see online consultation. You need help, but what you hear is not going to necessarily threaten the whole foundation. One of the more high-profile online consultations, just in the last two or so years, was about reforming criminal law procedure, right? And so this one got a lot of news at the two meetings a couple of years ago, right? It was discussed. And the interesting thing about that is the proposal was made public, and they supposedly got about 80,000 comments, none of which were disclosed. And then when you look 9 months later, when the final policy came out, it looked to move in the direction of the comments that were submitted. Now, how do we know what the comments said? Well, what a lot of people did is they submitted their comment in the government's architecture, and then they went right to Weibo and said, oh, by the way, I just sent in a comment, and here's my comment. So we don't have great data on that, but you have sort of spotty data where you can catch what people said about their comments on social media. And so that's another totally, from my vantage point, unexplored area of trying to understand these kinds of state civil society interactions. So I'd love to actually, in the long run, incorporate more on social media and what kinds of conversations are happening. How often does this happen that people actually then do post their comments to Weibo and things like that, and what does it mean? Thank you. Yeah, Donna.
In trying to think about a parallel to the U.S. situation, I'm thinking about the regulatory public comments, and that mostly it's organizations that respond rather than individuals. And did you have a sense, or could you tell, if these people, especially the ones that were providing data, these aren't the average citizens, so were they really representing some profession?
Yeah, so that was actually one of the questions I asked in the survey instrument, right? So in the U.S. context, the EPA issues a proposed clean air regulation. They're going to get, well, it used to be they'd get 10,000 comments. Now they get, 2.5 million comments because it's easier to do it online and mobilize your AstroTurf campaigns and all of that. So there are lots of individuals commenting, but they're really doing it as members of some mass organization. And it's those organizational comments that matter the most. So as somebody who studied these processes in the US for a long time, that's why I wanted to ask that question. And I didn't talk about it today because, maybe I should, because the results astonished me. Like, almost nobody. Like, first of all, when you look at the, if you can look at the comments for evidence of organization, you find very little, almost none. And then even when you ask them, were you submitting this? All right, maybe the organization's hidden. You know, it's somebody submitted it under their name, but they're really the head of some firm or... No, I mean, when you ask people that question, almost nobody says that they're sort of commenting in any kind of organizational way. So, I mean, that may not surprise us when we think about the differences in civil society across China and the U.S., but, like, that would be, like, a big, interesting question to ask in the U.S. context. Like, for example, does business dominate the commenting process? Like, that comment, that doesn't even make sense to ask that kind of question based on the kinds of patterns we're seeing in the commenters. So, so as somebody who came from a long history of studying this in the U.S., wow, it's a totally different kind of comment arena. But not in all regards. Like, I also went in with the expectation that there'd be a lot of cheerleading, and wow, like, almost none. It surprised me. Yeah. Yeah, Gwen.
So did you find any connection between, in terms of what the government is seeking consultations on, did you find any connection between what they're seeking comments on and their legal obligations to seek comment on them? I mean, I know that, for instance, there's laws that require seeking consultation on laws, regulations, and rules, not necessarily policies. Was there any actual impact of those requirements, or was it kind of random?
Yeah, so in this case, there wasn't that kind of legal obligation, which is one thing I was interested in. So there wasn't in this case. But that would be something I'd be interested in looking at, like, in the larger project, right? So, like, that could be even one, you know, one explanatory variable, if you will, that might separate those agencies out that do consultation from those that don't, right? What's their underlying legal environment? What are their obligations? But at least in this particular case, there was none to speak of. Yeah. Yeah, but that's a good idea to think about for the larger project. Thank you.
I guess that will do it.
Great.
So please join me in thanking Steve.
Hey, thank you. Great. Thanks for having me. Yeah, this glass is awesome. So the last time I was here, why do I think that Emerson was standing there? Or was I in a different...